is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Coach Steve Moore, and you're listening to the Hoopheads Podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years, and now with its integrated web platform, coaches have the ability to add video to plays and share them directly to their players' Android and iPhones via their mobile app. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. In addition to a great product, they also provide basketball coaching content and resources through their blog and PlayBank. For access to these plays and more information, visit FastModelSports.com or follow them on Twitter at FastModel.
If you want to be the best, okay, you're not the best at that time. You better figure out what the best is doing, and you better be able to do it the same, more importantly, do it better.
Dennis Hobson is in his second season as the men's basketball head coach at Lourdes University in Sylvania, Ohio. In his first season at Lourdes and as a collegiate head coach, Hobson led the Gray Wolves to a 20-11 record and a tie for third place in the Wolverine-Hoosier Athletic Conference. A native of Toledo, Hobson arrived at Lourdes with more than 30 years of basketball coaching, recruiting, and playing experience. Hobson played in the NBA for 5 seasons. He was the 3rd pick overall in the 1987 NBA draft by the New Jersey Nets, where he played for 3 years. He also had stints with the Chicago Bulls, where he won an NBA championship, and the Sacramento Kings. Following his NBA career, Hobson played 7 more years in Europe. Upon retiring from his playing career, Hobson was a regional scout for the Philadelphia 76ers in 2003-2004 before moving into the coaching ranks. He began his collegiate coaching career at Northwood University, where he served as an assistant coach for 2 years under head coach Raleigh Massimino. Hobson spent 2009 through 2014 as an assistant coach at Bowling Green State University for Coach Lewis Orr. Hobson worked 1 season as the head boys coach at Bedford High School and also served as the director of basketball operations for the YMCA of Greater Toledo prior to his arrival at Lourdes. Hobson was a standout player at The Ohio State University, where he was an All-American and the Big Ten Player of the Year in 1987. He is the Buckeyes' all-time leading scorer, tallying 2,096 points during his 4-year career. He also holds the school's single-season scoring record with 958 points in 86-87, a season in which he finished 2nd nationally in scoring. A member of the Ohio State Hall of Fame class of 1994, Hobson was named to the John Wooden All-American team and was named a first-team All-Big Ten selection in 1987. We recently launched the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Our roster of shows is growing, so don't forget to check out all our other podcasts on the Hoopheads Pod Network, including Thrive with Trevor Huffman, Beyond the Ball, the CoachMaze.com podcast, Players Court, Bleachers and Boards, the Green Light podcast, and our team-focused NBA pods, Cavalier Central, Grizz and Grind, Knuck If You Buck, 305 Culture, Blazing the Path, Hashtag Lakers, Motor City Hoops, X's and O's NBA Breakdown, Spanning the Spurs, LA Hoops, and Thunderous Applause. we're looking for more NBA podcasters interested in hosting their own show centered on a particular team. Email us info@hoopheadspod.com if you're interested in learning more and bringing your talent to our network. Grab your pen and paper so you can take some notes as you listen to this episode with Dennis Hopson, men's basketball head coach at Lourdes University in Sylvania, Ohio. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Linzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel, who is taking care of his young daughter tonight. So he left me Han Solo. But I am pleased to be welcoming to the podcast tonight Dennis Hopson, the head men's basketball coach at Lourdes University, former NBA player, the all-time leading scorer at The Ohio State University as a player. Dennis, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Appreciate it, Mike. Thanks for having me on, man.
Absolutely. I am super excited to be able to have a conversation with you and just learn about all the different things that you've been able to do in the game of basketball. Obviously, you have a long and storied career both as a player and as a coach. So I want to go back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about your first experiences with the game of basketball and what made you fall in love with the game as a young kid.
Well, I don't know if I fell in love with it as a young kid. I will say I had other things that I enjoyed doing. And if you asked me if I wanted to be a professional athlete when I was that age, I would tell you no. But I think it all started, it starts early. And I think what it was, I was a little more skilled than the rest of the kids that I played with and played against. And it started in elementary, fifth and sixth grade, and then went on to junior high. And then it went on to Bowser High School. And I think I really turned a corner at Bowser High School in regards to my play because I had a great supporting cast all the way through. But I think my high school coach, he recognized the talent that I had in me. And, you know, he really made me understand that I could do something with the game of basketball. And with that, you know, I had a great sophomore, junior, and senior season because, like a lot of people don't know, I didn't play as a freshman in high school.
Yeah, I read that. Tell us that story. I'm fascinated by that.
Man, you know, it was one of those things where I think it was a little bit of being spoiled and a little bit of being very, very immature. So I didn't play. I would rather work, which I did. I worked at McDonald's. And the reason for me working there was I wanted a car. Well, actually, I had a car, but I wanted to do certain things and special things to my car. So it was a way for me to make money to where I could do some things to my car.
So the car was a project. It wasn't that you wanted to go somewhere. It was that the car was a project for you.
It was something that I loved and enjoyed, man. I always loved cars and I still love cars. And again, it kind of took me away from basketball. And it's funny because, you know, I had one of the nicest cars at the age of 16 around the city of Toledo. So, you know, working a job for me was more important at that time. But again, as time went on, my sophomore year, you know, I got a feel for the game, played well. And then at the end of my sophomore year, I was on JV and they bumped me up to varsity, for like the last three or four games, I do believe, and was able to fare well on the varsity level. And then next year, which was my junior year, man, had a bang out season, had a great season, was first team all city and all state player. And then went on to my senior year and same thing, was a C League player of the year, first team all state, and finished up second to Kennard Johnson for, it wasn't called Mr. Basketball back then. It was just, you know, player of the state. So I finished second to him. And after that senior year, or during that senior year, I should say, I was being recruited by a lot of different schools. And a lot of people don't know this either, Mike. I committed to the University of Cincinnati, a verbal commitment to the University of Cincinnati. But the coach back then was Ed Badger, and Ed Badger had gotten fired. So I don't know if we called it decommitting back then, like right, they do now. Yeah, yeah. You know, I'm older guy now. I can't recall exactly what they called it back then. But I'm going to use the word decommitted from Cincinnati and committed to The Ohio State University. And again, I think I was a kid with a lot of talent and grace at a very young age. And the same thing held true when I went to Ohio State. But the big thing was that I really didn't understand the game of basketball. I played it, but I didn't really understand it. Started the majority of the year as a freshman, played pretty decent. But then my sophomore year, was a full-time starter, and that's when things really started to click. That's when I started to work on my craft a little more. I started watching film because, you know, that was available on the college level, unlike the high school level, and had a bang out sophomore year. And then my junior year, I really turned it on. And I played with a guy by the name of Brad Sellers. He was a senior. And I actually led a team in scoring that year. My junior year, I averaged 20 points a game. And he went on – I was a junior. He was a center, senior. He went on to be drafted by Chicago. And after that junior year, I felt that I had an opportunity to become an NBA player. And my senior year, came around to my senior year, and I was picked as one of the top players in the league. And I had a bang-out senior year. And it's funny because – our coach got fired my junior year, but he finished out the season. He got fired. Eldon Miller got fired towards the end of the year, but he finished out the year with us, and we went on to win the NIT tournament that year. And again, I led the team in scoring. And when he got fired, it was kind of one of those things to where, well, who's coming in? Who's going to come in and coach you? You know, is he going to allow you to do what Coach Miller allowed me to do? During his time at Ohio State, and sure enough, a guy by the name of Gary Williams got hired. And, you know, I was very excited because they had just got through kicking our butts on CBS on national TV when he was with Boston College that same year, my junior year. And I just loved the way that he played. I loved his style. So Gary Williams had come to Ohio State my senior year, and, you know, he allowed me to do what I wanted to do within the concept of the team. And I ended up averaging 29 points a game, second in the nation in scoring. And, you know, Big Ten Player of the Year, All-American, got a lot of great awards. And none of that would have happened without the great teammates that I played with, because they allowed me to be me. And, you know, they put me in certain situations to where I could be successful. And after that year, I was considered either number one or number two shooting guard in the country behind Reggie Williams. You know, certain people would say Reggie was number one. Certain people would say I was number one. So no matter what, it was either going to be me or him that went to the New Jersey Nets or the Los Angeles Clippers. And I was fortunate to go third to the New Jersey Nets, and he went fourth through the Los Angeles Clippers.
Could you wrap your head around that at that point in your life, going kind of from, hey, I'm not even going to go out for the basketball team as a freshman because I want to work and I want to have this car. Was it something that in the moment that you were processing because it was gradual enough, or what was your mindset like at that point?
Yeah, I think after my junior year, again, I never had big expectations when I went to Ohio State. You know, I know you can ask some young kids now when they're young, you know, 9, 10, 11 years old, what do you want to be? The first thing they're going to say is some type of professional athlete, be it football or be it basketball. But for me, that just wasn't the case back then. So to answer your question, if I could wrap my mind around it, I probably didn't start thinking about that thinking that I was going to be visualizing that into my junior year. And I said, you know, you learn to play the game. You learn how to play this game pretty decent. You might have a shot at the next level. And, you know, when you start reading about yourself or people telling you what they've read in different publications and that type of thing, it just kind of lets you know, kind of can, you know, confirms that, you know, you might have an opportunity to take this and do something with it out of Ohio State. And I was able to do that, man. So yeah, it was a thing to where I probably didn't start thinking about it until my junior year in college.
And how did you go about, like, what did your summers look like from the time you were in high school through the time you're at Ohio State? How did your preparation for the season change from, let's say, between your sophomore and junior year of high school, where that's kind of where you take that first leap? You're a JV player as a sophomore, you called up the varsity at the end of the year, and then the next year you make this leap to where you know, you're now going to become a major college prospect, all the way up through, okay, now you're at Ohio State. Clearly, you're having a lot of success there. What do your summers look like in terms of you working on your game and improving? Are you playing pickup ball places? Are you in the gym by yourself? What's that look like?
Well, you're on the concrete. You know, back then, you know, you're talking, you're talking about the 80s. I'm 80s, you know. So you're on the concrete, you know, in 80 degree weather outside, but on the concrete it's probably 100 degrees. But you're out there and you're self-taught. You know, Mike, you're self-taught, man, as far as the personal trainers and the shooting machines and all the things that the kids have today. We didn't have that back then. You're self-taught, but we just played, man. We played sun up to sun down. And again, I was able to be effective and efficient without all the things that the kids have today because I just had a better understanding of the game. Now, did I know what was going on like that? No. Back then, no. All I did was play. Okay. And I could put myself a step ahead of the people that I was playing against, no matter who it was, older, younger, always a step ahead. But we just played. We were self-taught back then, man. And I think, again, like I mentioned a little bit ago, I think it really clicked for me after my sophomore year in college. That's when I really started to go out and do individual skill work, you know, wherever I can do that. At the university or one of the courts on campus outside, and just work at it, man. And then start. And then the other thing that helped my growth was watching film. You know, I watched a ton of film back then. I watched myself. I watched my opponents. And again, having great teammates, man, that allowed me to be me. That was very helpful as well.
Where was your go-to park when you were back in that era? Where were you going to play? Where were you finding games?
Ryder Park. That's what we call Ryder Park. R-R-Y-D-E-R Park on Nebraska here in Toledo, Ohio. That's where I grew up playing and played all the way through, man. And again, like I said, we had a lot of talent here. So, you know, they would come to our side of town and play at our park. We would go to their side of town and play at their parks. So we always had good runs. You know, we never had to worry about, you know, finding a competitive game.
It's amazing how different the basketball world is today. When you think about that era, I'm 50, so I grew up sort of in the same era that you did. Mm-hmm. It's just incredible to think about. I remember driving around and going to find places here in Cleveland. I got to find this gym, you know, on a Tuesday, on a Tuesday night, this is the court where guys are going to be playing. And on a Sunday night, this is where you need to be. And it's just, you know, now you look at the way that kids grow up, and obviously there's a huge number of advantages that kids have, and you mentioned a couple of them, just having gym access and trainers and having the shooting machine and the number of reps you can get. But I think there's something to be said for going and just playing pickup games against people of all different ages and from all different communities and backgrounds and races and everything else. And it's just, I think there's an education that kids today miss out on that you and I were lucky enough to be able to participate in, just because you're playing against people from all different walks of life and all different ages. And I think you learn things not only about yourself as a basketball player, but I think you also develop as a human being put into those environments as well.
Yeah, you do. I mean, again, you just said it, you know, you're playing against different personalities, different attitudes. And again, you more importantly, you're self-taught. You learn how to adjust without somebody, you know, right there by your side. You know, you adjust. If you're playing a game of basketball, you adjust. All right, you know you're playing against certain people, you adjust. It unlike today with the kids today. So yeah, I think, you know, I had an opportunity to be a kid, okay, for one. But then more importantly, I had an opportunity to learn from some of the older guys around town because they took you under their wings. And then I had an opportunity to be around good people, man, good family, you know, mom, dad, brothers and sisters, people in the community, people in the neighborhood, people in the state, you know. So I think, again, all that had a lot to do with my growth as a person and a basketball player.
When you think back to your time at Ohio State, what were the differences between Coach Miller and Coach Williams when you think back to the three years you spent with Coach Miller and then the 1 year you spent with Coach Williams?
Both great, you know, but the difference between the two was Coach Miller was very conservative, okay? If you were a freshman, more than likely you were going to be you were going to have to learn, okay? And it was okay with learning, all right? I was fortunate because I was learning, but I still had the opportunity to play a lot, if not start. Again, I probably started half of the games as a freshman, all right? And then Coach Williams was – I mean, I'm sorry, Coach Miller was big on the fundamentals, okay? He taught fundamentals. Now, Gary Williams gets there. That wasn't his thing. His thing was, if you're going to be on this level, you should already know fundamentals, okay? Or you should go somewhere else. You shouldn't be here, okay? His thing was, I need to implement my full court pressure. I need to implement some offense, and we need to – here's a basketball. You guys go out and play. Okay, so again, you had a conservative coach my first 3 years, and then you had a coach that was very aggressive, very, you know, up-tempo type of style of play. So, you know, again, I learned from both. You know, again, I think that, and I do it now as a coach. I think working on skill work is very, very important. You do it 20 minutes a day in practice, okay? But at the end of the end, I think, again, when you're playing basketball, depending on what level you're on, you should have a good feel for the game.
Absolutely.
So I learned from both. I learned from Coach Miller and I learned from Coach Williams.
That's good that you took that attitude. I think sometimes, you know, obviously you can get caught up when there's a coaching change, and sometimes players, you know, you get stuck where one guy you meshed with and then the next guy comes in and for whatever reason it doesn't mesh. And obviously you had a different level of talent than what most people have when you go through a coaching change. But still, to be able to adapt and adjust and see the positive in both guys clearly is a credit to you.
Do you know where to hit the backboard for the highest percentage shots? Do you know when using the backboard is better than taking a direct shot? Be certain that you are taking the highest percentage shots by training with the Shoticle. The Shoticle mounts on your backboard to give you the location of the highest percentage shots. Train with the Shoticle and you will score more. Basketball is a data-driven game, so don't ignore the data and the facts. We worry about the data so you can focus on shooting. Visit Shoticle.com now and start scoring more.
When you think back to your time there, what's your favorite memory of St. John Arena? When I think of Ohio State basketball, despite the fact that obviously, they're playing at the Shot now, and the high school championships aren't at St. John Arena anymore. But when I think of Ohio State basketball and I think of Ohio high school basketball, I still think of St. John Arena. So what's your favorite memory of playing in St. John?
The fans. You know, I mean, it was a intimate place to play because everybody was right there. You know, if you're sitting on a bench – you could turn around and you could give somebody five because they're right there. They're right on top of you. And it just made for a warm feeling, man, when you run up and down the court, man, and you got people sitting right there on top of you. So if I had to say or pick one thing, it would be the fans, man, because you run out 15-4 or 14-5, you know, that St. John's would hold. As far as the fans and it was full every night. It was full every night, man, cheering us on. So, you know, that was an experience and a feeling that, you know, if somebody asked me about St. John Arena, that's the first thing that's going to come to mind is the fans.
Yeah, it makes total sense. I think that there's, you know, when you get an opportunity, and I've been in places where you play in front of a packed house of fans. And then I've been in situations where you play where there's almost nobody there. And when you get an opportunity to play in front of a packed house, especially a packed house at Ohio State and St. John Arena, which, as you said, fans are right on top of you. It just is such an intimate place, as you described, to play basketball. To me, there's nothing better than playing in front of a rabid fan base. And that could be your own fans, obviously, when you're talking about a home arena. But I think it's also fun to play and coach in an environment where you're on the road and you're playing in that same, you know, you're playing almost against the fans when they're that much into it. I always had nearly as much fun playing in a hostile road environment as you do playing in a home environment.
You do, because it's funny, because you always hear that the fans are that sixth man. You always hear that. And they actually are. They actually are, man. I mean, there's a lot of games that I'm sure teams win or have won because of the fans. And again, it gets everything flowing. It gets everything pumping. It generates excitement. A place like St. John Arena, and it's funny because, you know, on my visit, that was one of the things that excited me when I was there, to walk in that arena and to see all those people. It was big time. It was big time.
Had you ever been to an Ohio State basketball game before you got involved in the recruiting process?
You know, if I have, I was young because my sister graduated from Ohio State a long time ago, and Calvin Ramsey played with my brother in high school. So he was one of the reasons why I went to Ohio State. But I can't – if I have, Mike, I can't really put my finger on it.
Gotcha.
So it would probably – but what I can remember is, yeah, I did go when I was being recruited.
Nice. All right, so let's jump ahead to you getting prepared for – the NBA draft after your senior season at Ohio State. What do you remember about the pre-draft process and what you had to go through, both in terms of your own preparation and then what it was like as teams tried to decide whether or not they were going to draft you? What do you remember about the whole process?
Well, I can't remember some things. I either was going to go first, second, or third. Okay, but I knew David Robinson was in the draft, even though he wasn't going to be able to play for the first couple years. Didn't know what it was going to look like. Okay, but was getting phone calls from New Jersey, Phoenix, and Los Angeles Clippers. Okay, so I knew it could be 2, 3, or 4, and I went to visit all three of those teams. All three had me come for my interview and my workout. All right. I knew I was either one or two, the first or second shooting guard, and vice versa for Reggie Williams. Interviews, you know, they bring you in, they interview you, they're going to work you out. And I had a great, great time at all the three different places that I went to, you know, Phoenix, New Jersey, and the Clippers. Had a great time. I knew that some of those organizations, though, were pretty down. They had been down for some years. New Jersey was one of them. And the Clippers, they weren't very strong either. That's why they had the high picks. So I do recall that. All right. And then it just really just came down to the draft. But during that time, leading up to that time, I didn't play in Portsmouth. I never played in Portsmouth, okay, because the top guys didn't play in Portsmouth. Portsmouth was to try to – it was a place for guys to play to try to better their positioning in regards to the draft. But no, we weren't – it wasn't mandatory for the top guys to play in Portsmouth, which I don't even know if they have now. I don't think they have that anymore. Draft came around and you had David Robinson, you had Armon Gilliam, and then you had myself at 3, and you had Reggie Williams at 4. And that was 87 draft, which was a great, 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 great draft class. You know, some of those guys were going to be top 50 players in the NBA. So yeah, it was a great draft that year.
So you get to New Jersey, just talk a little bit about what that adjustment was like from college to pro basketball. What did you immediately like about it? What was different about it? Just think back on that time when you first got to New Jersey.
I'm going to tell you the biggest thing, the number one thing for me is the East Coast over the Midwest. Okay. For me, the East Coast is fast. All right. The East Coast is very, very fast. It's big. Versus me being a Toledo guy and then going down to Columbus, to where Columbus is a little bigger than Toledo at the time. I mean, it's much bigger now.
Right.
So the biggest thing for me was a Midwestern kid going to the East Coast. That was tough. That was tough, you know, away from family, a big place. You're 21, 22 years old. So that was really the toughest part for me.
Where'd you live that first year? Did you buy a home? What'd you do that first year?
I was renting in a high rise in Secaucus.
Okay.
Secaucus, New Jersey. Okay. And right over the bridge was Manhattan. And then as time went on a couple years later, or the following year, I built a house out in Mahwah, New Jersey. And that was out a little ways. But Buck Williams, he kind of took me under his wing, and he kind of helped me as far as navigating my way through New Jersey and, you know, telling me what was good and what wasn't good. But, yeah, and then, you know, as a player, the biggest thing was my mindset versus me being drafted so high. Okay, if I could turn back the times and go back, I would have a completely different mindset. And I don't know another word I can use outside of a selfish mindset. Okay, I would have a very selfish mindset because those are the guys that survive. But I think the way that I played the game my whole life coming up was I was always a team guy. You know, even though I averaged 29 points a game as a senior, I was still second on the team in assists, first on the team in steals. Okay, so, you know, I've always been taught to be a team guy. But again, I think, you know, when you're drafted high, the expectations are you got to figure out how you're going to turn this franchise around. Okay, well, I didn't have that type of mindset. My mindset was fitting in to the franchise, fitting in with the New Jersey Nets. Okay, because you had Otis Birdsong, okay, all-star, Buck Williams. I think Buck was an all-star. So we had some very talented guys on the team. All right, but again, you're still looked at as, okay, you're still looked at as the savior. All right, you're a high draft pick. You got to come in here. You got to make some noise. All right, well, again, I crawled before I walked. And what I should have done was I should have just started walking and then running right away. You know, if that makes sense to you.
It makes total sense. I think that is a case where when you think about either – I think about players I've coached or I think about my playing career, you think about trying to fit in versus trying to stand out. And I think that a lot of times players do struggle with that. You struggle with that mentality, and it's a different – as you said, it's a different mindset when you say coming in, you know, hey, I'm the man versus, hey, I'm going to come in and I want to contribute in a bunch of different ways and just kind of be the guy who fits in. And a lot of times – and I'm sure players all throughout the history of the NBA that have been top five picks have felt that pressure to some degree where it's like, okay, if I'm picked in the top five, teams are expecting me to come in and, as you said, instantly turn them around and go from, hey, we're going from 23 wins, we're going to win 50 games. And for most guys, that's just not – A, it's just not realistic. And then B, I think when you look at trying to get in there, and as you said, if you do try to fit in – then sometimes I think people tend to look at it and be like, hey, why isn't this guy doing more? And it sounds like you felt like you should have just said, hey, they're going to live with my mistakes. They're going to live with me maybe stepping out of my comfort zone, and I should have just gone for it instead of trying to hang back and fit in.
There you go. And you know, there were so many factors there. You know, you had an unstable franchise that had been that way for some time. All right. Good players, but – you know, just didn't have the winning mindset, all right? And I think sometimes you can fall into or accept, okay, well, we're losing. This is who we are, you know? And I think some of those guys were at that point, okay, when I got there. Then the other thing, too, Mike, was, you know, different owners. I think we had like 10 or 12 owners at that time, all right? And then I had, during my time there, I had five different coaches. You know, guys getting hired. Dave Wool got fired after our first, which was the head coach, our first 19 games or so. I don't know. But he got fired. They bring somebody else in. Okay. So it was for me, it was a tough situation. No excuses here, but it was a tough situation. And I was used to consistency. Okay. I just came from consistency my whole life. So that was kind of tough. But again, you know, I can't worry about it now.
Right.
But all I can do is educate other guys, you know, that might have that opportunity to go on and play at that level or any level for that fact, any level, you know. That's what I'm here for, to take.
Yeah. I think that's so true.
Yeah.
I think I think you hear a lot of times you'll hear announcers talk about, hey, this guy's got to go to the right situation, or you'll hear about you know, some draft picks. And when you're talking about the NBA draft, I think this happens every year where they'll talk about, well, if this guy goes to this situation, it's going to be perfect for him because it's a stable organization. The coach has been there for 3 or 4 years. He's got veteran guys who are professionals that know what to do. And so if he comes into this environment, it's going to be perfect. Conversely, he could go to organization X where, as you said, they've had 5 coaches in the last 3 years and they've had all this turnover. And I think there's something to be said for that, that you have to be in position. And I think if you take that to coaching, one of the things that's your job as a coach is to put your players in the best position to be able to help them to succeed. And I think that when you look at not just your career, but there's a lot of guys that you can look at their career and say, man, this guy who was such a talented player ended up just going to a situation that maybe didn't maximize their potential of what they could have been. And it's, you know, I think that that's something that happens to, it probably happens more than any of us would like to think about.
Right. Because you can't, my thing is, like I tell people, you can't go from being able to play one day to not being able to play on Tuesday to not being able to play on Wednesday. It just don't happen like that. Like you said, it's just one of those things that situations and fit is very, very important. I mean, in whatever it is that you do, you know, working a 9-to-5 job. I mean, if the situation's not right and it's a bad fit, it's not going to be a great environment for you, your employer, whoever you're working for. So, you know, it was one of those things. But, you know, went on the average, I think 9 point something that freshman, I mean, my rookie year to 12 point something my second year to leading them in scoring my third year. Okay. Now, during this time, after going through coaches and different things, now we get Bill Fitch in there. Okay. Well, Bill Fitch's thing was we didn't see eye to eye. And again, if I had to do it all over again, I was young, probably would understand a little more because now I'm a coach, but I don't want to hear about what used to go on with the Boston Celtics when you're coaching the New Jersey Nets. I don't want to hear about Larry Bird, Robert Parrish, and those guys. You know, I'm trying to make a name for myself. They already have a name. So, you know, we didn't see eye to eye. And, you know, after that third year, after leading the team and scoring, I guess there was some type of trade value there. Yeah. And they traded me on to Chicago. You know, was pissed about that trade because a lot of people were excited about it because my thing was I'm on my way now. I'm getting a feel for the NBA game. I'm starting to come around. Why are you going to send me here to where I'm going to be playing behind the best player in the world? Okay, and it's just going to kind of stunt my growth a little bit because I'm not going to be getting the minutes that I was getting in New Jersey. Okay, so it was one of them things, man, again, like you just touched on it. Timing and being in the right situation, it means a lot.
What did you hear from the Bulls? So when you get – obviously, you probably don't have much of a conversation with New Jersey's management and coaching staff at that point when they ship you out, but I'm assuming when you come into Chicago that they at least – give you some explanation for, hey, why they're bringing you in. So do you remember that conversation or do you remember what they told you when they first brought you in of what they were looking to get out of you at that point?
Well, it was more like, okay, you're getting new life. You're getting new opportunity. You're going to get a new opportunity. Okay. Playing for a team that's competing for the Eastern Conference Championship. But they've been, you know, they've fallen short. We're just trying to get some pieces that can come in here and help. Never was promised anything, you know, but like I said, I heard that conversation, but didn't really pay much attention to that conversation. I was more focused on you're getting ready to play behind the best player in the country. How many minutes are going to be left for you to play? That was my focus. Okay. So, you know, and I had just come off a knee surgery, so I don't know that, you know, I was fully engaged in the whole situation, okay? And again, you know, spotty minutes, 4-point-something points a game to win an NBA championship, okay? It's great. That's great because, you know, you got a lot of megastars that don't win NBA championships. So I did get something out of it. But I think it kind of set me back a little bit. And then after that, traded on after the fourth game, the second season, traded to Sacramento to where I got new life again. It was perfect. You know, Mitch Richmond had just gotten traded there. Spud Webb had just got traded there. So new life. I don't know, a little over 18 to 20 minutes a game, but I averaging 10.7 points or 10.4 points a game in the time that I was getting. So here now I'm coming back. So again, man, I think, you know, not just with my situation, it's with everybody's situation. You know, timing, being in the right place at the right time, man, is so important. It's so important.
Yeah, I think there's no question about that. And we'll get into your next step after Sacramento, what happened when you left Sacramento. And I know I saw something on the internet where you talked about it being the worst advice that you ever got from your mm-hmm. agent. We'll talk about that.
Hey, hoopheads, we all hate ankle sprains, and they happen way too often. Ankle injuries are the number one sports-related injury. Arise is trying to change that. With the iFast, your athletes get preventative protection and full mobility. Athletes no longer need to wear bulky braces that limit performance and give mediocre protection. Anyone playing sports should be using these products. Keep your athletes in the game. Don't wait for them to get hurt to take action. Visit www.arise.com, spelled A-R-Y-S-E, and use the code HOOPHEADS to get 20% off the future of performance. That's A-R-Y-S-E.com with promo code HOOPHEADS to get 20% off.
I think I would be remiss if I didn't ask you to at least share one. What's your favorite story of Michael Jordan from the time you were there? Is there anything that you've shared in the past or something that sticks out to you when you think about the time that you spent with Jordan there in Chicago for the 1 year when he wins his first title?
You know, I don't know that I have one story, man. It's I have a whole year of just being with, and again, this is what I did enjoy about being in Chicago, is that they brought back the competitive edge that I started with at New Jersey, that kind of got depleted a little bit because of the situation. Okay. But it brought back the guys in Chicago brought back that competitive edge. Okay. Because they competed, man. I mean, I don't have one story about him. You know, there's a lot of stories, and every story that I would probably say about him is that he's a competitor, man. he's a super, super competitor, man. And again, what I loved about him is he was gonna make everybody around him work. Okay, he wasn't going to settle for you just loafing.
Right.
He wasn't going to settle for that because he had a vision, man. He had something in mind, and he knew he was very, very close to getting it, but he just couldn't get over the hump to get it, and that was to try to win the championship. Okay, so again, his daily routine was going to be competitive no matter what it was. So, you know, again, just to say, give me one story, I don't know that I can just give you one story, but I can give you a lot of stories, and every story is going to be about him being a super competitive guy.
Yeah, I think that when you think about what his reputation was then, but I think that super competitive nature was always talked about then, but I think it's grown even more in legendary status, and obviously with The Last Dance, and people who are a lot younger than us who maybe never saw him play in his prime got reintroduced to that competitive nature that clearly came through in the documentary, and you got to see some things behind the scenes as a fan that maybe you weren't privy to before that certainly made you realize and understand better just what type of competitor that guy was day in and day out. And so for you to be able to win and get your title. Where's your title? Where's your championship ring right now? Where do you keep it?
In my safe, right here in my safe.
Nice.
And I'll bring it out. I'll bring it out if I'm going to speak at a camp, you know, to some young kids, or I know people are going to be asking me about it. I'll bring it out and let the guys and girls see and the parents see.
Yeah.
But that's the only time I really bring it out.
Gotcha. All right. Explain what happened at the end of that year in Sacramento where you thought things were going in the right direction, and your agent gave you some advice. Just talk a little bit about that and where that sent your career.
Yeah. You know, it's again, I think, you know, when you're young, life is all about learning and growing. And had a great year, okay? And I never forget this. Getting calls every day from Sacramento. Hey, you know, Gary St. James, he was the general manager at that time. Hey, you know, we want to get this thing done. But their whole thing was that we only could give you a one-year deal, okay, because of, I guess, all the things that they had been doing in the past financially to where, you know, they were still taking care of certain players and, you know, that type of thing. So the one-year thing is, in my mind, was, you know, I'm young. And you see guys signing for multi-year deals. And my thing was that. Now, my agent was one, you know, he just felt that, you know, it was a bluff and we should be able to get a multi-year deal. And they kept saying, look, we just drafted Walt Williams. It's not there. But what the good thing about this is that if you sign a one-year deal, you can become unrestricted at that. And then you can go anywhere else if somebody else wants to, you know, pick you up if you don't want to stay here after the one-year deal. And I would never, ever forget, man, Brad Sellers. He was overseas at the time. He was calling me like, hop, man, take the deal, man, take the deal. All right. But again, not knowing much and having an agent to where you relied upon, I'm listening to him. And, you know, time kept going on. Time was going on. And they called me. And then one day they called me and said, look, if you don't want to take this, we got somebody else on the hook that we will sign. And that person is Vincent Askew, if you don't want it, you know. And, you know, I think we called their bluff, and they ended up going in a different direction. Long story short, man, I went overseas and, you know, had a great deal and doing some things over there. But, you know, being overseas is not like being home. Even though I played in big time and great places, it's still not like being home. But, hey, you live and you learn. And, again, that's just another teaching point that I will offer a young man or a young girl that's in the same situation. You know, take the guarantee. Don't gamble. You know, a penny today is worth more than a penny tomorrow.
Very true. Very, very true. All right. So let's briefly touch on, before we get into your coaching career, let's briefly talk about your overseas playing career. I want to ask you two questions. First question is, what was your favorite country, city that you played in? And then two, this is a standard question I have to ask everybody who plays overseas because everybody has one. What's your craziest European basketball story? Because everybody has one story that just is sort of unbelievable to American basketball fans anyway.
Well, I'm going to tell you, I have a few favorite places. I'm going to say Spain, France, and Israel. You know, because, again, Mike, you got to understand, you know, when some of those guys go over there, they're playing in third world countries.
Right, okay? For sure. Yep.
Well, Denison playing in third world countries. You know, I played in big time country where, you know, I'm close to Paris, I'm close to Madrid, I'm in Tel Aviv. I'm in places where we got American food, everybody speaks English. So it's a little different for me. All right. Some of those guys, it's not like that. But those three were great places, man. Were great places for me. And I think if you talk about a horror story or something bad, is that the good thing is that they love their basketball. The bad thing is that, man, they like throwing coins and stuff out on the court and different things, you know, like that. So, you know, hey, love the fact that they were big basketball supporters. Didn't like the fact that at times a couple coins might come flying out on the court because they are head over heels when it comes to their basketball, man. They're very committed to the team that they like, and if something is going wrong, they're going to let you're going to feel it and you're going to see it.
Yeah, there's always, I think, those stories of things that happen, and I think that throwing things out on the court is something that clearly happens a lot more frequently overseas than it does here in the States.
Right.
Thankfully, let's put it that way. Thankfully, right. Thankfully, that's the case. I don't want to have to be dodging coins as a coach or as a player.
That's
so
right.
As your playing career starts to come to an end and you start to see retirement in your future, what are you thinking about? Was coaching on your horizon? I know you started out your first job back in basketball, I believe, is with the Sixers as a scout. But just kind of give us an idea of what your mindset was as your playing career was wrapping up, what were you thinking your post-playing career was going to look like?
Well, I think everybody, athlete, the first thing they think about is business. You know, doing something business-wise. But, you know, after doing some things, you quickly learn that, you're stepping over into an arena that you don't have a lot of knowledge about. And the people that you might be getting involved with, they have a whole lot of knowledge about. So you quickly understand that, is this what you want to do? Or if it is what you want to do, you better educate yourself real quick.
Absolutely.
So nobody takes advantage of you. Okay. So, you know, again, going back and forth. But the biggest thing was, man, I still had some unfinished business, Mike. And that was after we lost to Georgetown at Ohio State. I quit school. I stopped going to school. I withdrew from school to try to get ready for the draft. So I was a year and two quarters away from getting my degree. So at this time, when, like you just asked a question, when I was winding down, it's like, you know, the first thing on the agenda slash plate is you better go back to school and get your degree, because you made a promise to yourself. More importantly, you made a promise to your mother and your father. She's going to get your degree. So when I was done, man, I went back to school at the age of 40. I went back to school at the age of 40 and sat in a class with people like Ted Ginn and those guys back then. Graduated after a year and a half. And it's a funny story. Was talking about coaching, you know, doing some work with the Sixers, and every time I spoke to somebody about college coaching, you know what the first thing that would come up was, you don't have a college degree. You got to have a college degree to coach on the college level. Okay. So that's what, again, getting that degree was so important, because right after I got that degree, Ohio State was in the tournament, and I think they may have made it to the Final Four. Okay. Back then. Well, I'm in line to pick up my tickets for the tournament, and Rolly Massimino is right in front of me. So, you know, we start talking again. It's just one of those things where, I know you as well. So we start talking, and, you know, he asked me what I was doing. And I'm like, you know what, I want to get into college basketball. And he was like, well, huh, it's funny. You know, I just started a program at Northwood University in West Palm Beach, Florida. And I'm going to be looking for an assistant. One thing led to another, man. He flew me to West Palm Beach, Florida. We talked, and he hired me right on the spot. So I moved to West Palm for 2 years. And after those 2 years, Bowling Green, myself and Louis Orr connected, and I got hired by Bowling Green. Spent 5 years in Bowling Green before we got fired. And then I took a high school job. And I did 1 year. High school is not for me. It was too much. It's too easy for people to get to you, like parents and stuff. You know what I mean? It's, you know, by phone, waiting for you after the games, just, you know, and I was like, no, I don't, you know, this is not for me. So, you know, took some time after that and started doing some things. My personal programs, like Hobson Elite, and doing a lot of training and that type of thing. And they're connected with Lawrence University.
All right. So I want to go back to your first experience with Rolly and talk a little bit about what about coaching when you got that first job? How was it different maybe than what you thought it was going to be like, in terms of, were there things that were surprising to you about the coaching profession that maybe from the perspective of you as a player, you didn't realize that coaches spent so much time doing X or Y? What was it about coaching that maybe was different from what your perspective was as a player?
Well, one is, when you're a player, it's all about you worry about you. Okay. As a coach, you got to worry about a team. It's more than just you. Okay. Now you know, as a player, you're going to watch film. Okay. You're going to watch film because you need to know your opponent. All right. But as a coach, you're watching film, you're doing scouting reports, you're talking about scouting, you're talking about game plan, you're talking about a lot of different things, okay, if you want to be good and successful. So it's two totally different things, okay? Again, As a player, it's you know your job, do your job. As a coach, you got to know different personalities. You know, I need to be able to talk to Johnny like this. I can talk to David like this. I can talk to Kenny like this. Okay, you got to know your personnel. Okay, within your program, you got to know your opponents that you're going to be playing against, non-conference and in your conference. Okay, so there's just so much that you have that goes into being a coach. If you want to be good, that people don't really understand.
All right, what's the main difference for you, or what did you experience as the main difference between being an assistant at the NAI level and then being an assistant at the Division I level when you went to Bowling Green? Was there a big difference in your mind, or was it just a matter of the two levels in name and maybe the size, strength, ability of the players, but the job was pretty similar? How would you describe the difference between the two jobs?
Well, outside of athleticism, strength, speed, on the two the two levels, the NAI and mid major Bowling Green, is mindset. It's mindset. I think when you're coaching D1, everybody on a D1 level thinks you're going to be a professional athlete. Okay, so when they leave that locker room, Mike, or when they step between the lines, all right, I think their mindset, okay, is I'm going to be a professional athlete. So I'm going to go out here and I'm going to play hard all the time. All right. NAI level, I don't know if they shoot for that. And again, that's one of the things where I struggle as a coach sometimes. It's like, what is your motivation? Okay. What is your passion when you step between these lines? Okay. You got to have something that's going to drive you. All right. Because if you do, yeah, that means you're going to go out there and you're going to compete hard. But sometimes I think some of my guys, they feel like, well, I'm not going to be a professional athlete. I'm not going to have the opportunity when I'm done here. So this for me is just I'm out here playing. Okay, I'm out here playing. The other thing is, you know, D1, if somebody's on a team and they're not a preferred walk-on, they're getting a scholarship. Okay, NAI level, some of these kids will get athletic and academic money, but more than likely they're not getting a full scholarship, so they're paying some of their tuition as well. Okay, so again, the mindset for me is not always the way I want it to be on an NAI level, but like I tell my guys, you might not be a pro when you're done playing here, but at the end of the day, everybody has pride. Everybody, you should have it, because no matter what happens, you ought to be prideful enough to where, no matter what the situation is, I'm going to make sure that I'm at my best. I'm competing. I'm doing what I need to do. That's what pride should do for you.
Is that a day in, day out conversation with your kids now?
It is. It is. I mean, I just had two in the office today talking about it at different times. You know, because again, I'm trying to figure out the as a coach, the worst thing that you can experience, Mike, as a coach is not knowing your team, not knowing what team you're going to get from game to game, okay? Not having identity. That's the worst thing as a coach, okay? Because you do what you do. You go through your game plan. You give your pregame speech. You go out on the court. And it's very frightening when you don't know what team you're going to get out there playing at that.
Yep.
Very frightening.
Absolutely.
It is. So that, you know, and again, that's something that I have to figure out. Not even, we won 20 games last year, didn't figure it out last year, and I'm still working on it today. So I'm always trying to talk about, use different situations, different quotes, different things that other people might say, or LeBron James or Michael Jordan. I'm always trying to figure out what I can do to drive my team.
Yeah, I think being able to tap into that motivation, and then I would guess that it's also trying to figure out and tap into not just the team as a whole, but each individual player, and figuring out what makes them tick, whether it's through just having them in the office, or, you know, walking the campus with them, or having lunch with them. Just how do you go about getting into the mind of each one of your players so that you can figure out what it is that motivates them? Because it may be different for each individual guy.
You do. You do a lot of individual things. Okay. You do, you know, you do a lot of talking to your coaches and say, hey, man, you know, pull such and such aside and see if you can get something out of it. Okay. Or take such and such to lunch and see what he's talking about. Okay. So there's a lot, again, there's so many different avenues you travel to try to pull out the best in everybody that's on your team.
Hey coaches, parents, and group leaders. I want to introduce you to our newest sponsor, SnapRaise. SnapRaise is the nation's largest digital donation platform built to help teams, youth groups, and clubs raise money quickly and efficiently without selling products. SnapRaise builds your group a customizable campaign website, and students use their mobile devices to connect and engage with their biggest fans. My son's high school team used SnapRaise this season, and our team raised all the money they needed to fund their season, and then some. Getting SnapRaise started is quick and free. Just visit SnapRaise.com, and you'll get connected to a local SnapRaise expert in no time.
What did you learn in your time as an assistant coach that helped you when you made the transition from assistant to head coach? And you can either take that from, you know, you already talked a little bit about your high school experience, but let's just take it probably more from the college experience. What did you take from being an assistant that helped you in the transition to becoming the head coach at Lourdes?
Well, Coach Massimino, and I would say Coach Orr, keep it about family. You know what I mean? Keep it about family. You know, let the kids know that you care. Let the kids know that you're here for them. You're in their corner. Because, you know, trust is – with kids today, man, trust is a big thing. If they feel like they can trust you, then they'll come to you and they'll break bread with you no matter what the situation is. If they don't trust you, that's a different story. That's a different story. Okay, so the big thing that, you know, from both of the guys that I were – that I was, I'm sorry, an assistant under – Coach Mass and Coach Orr, you know, keep it family, man. Just let them know that you care, and keep your door open, keep your phone open, with no matter what time it is, to talk to any of them if they did pick up the phone and call you at 3, 4, 5 in the morning, because you never know what they're calling about.
So what does that look like? I mean, other than keeping your door open and keeping your phone line open, what does it look like building trust? How do you go about doing that day to day? Are there things that you're doing intentionally within the team, within the practice setting, within team meetings, team meals, or is it more just of a informal before practice? I'm going down and guys are warming up. They're doing their stretching and maybe I'm sitting next to them and talking to them at that point. So just how do you go about building that trust? What's that look like?
Well, you know, just like you said, I think it has to be bigger than just the whole basketball piece. You gotta let them know that you care. Like this summer, I had them over to the house. Okay, I had a big cookout for them. Had them over to the house. They were outside playing, you know, throwing a football, playing basketball, that type of thing. But I think you talked about earlier knowing your audience, knowing personalities. Okay, knowing what can be said, what can't be said. Knowing that, you know, again, call them on the telephone. Hey man, how you doing today? And like with the COVID-19 thing going on right now, you know, we have a lot of Zoom calls, and actually we're going to have one tomorrow, you know, just kind of staying available, man, letting them see you. Like I'm in the office daily. Some of them come in the gym and work out. They might come upstairs and get the key to get in the locker room. You know, hey man, sit down for a minute. Let me talk to you. You know, what are you doing? What are your workouts looking like? You know, we might go back. We might start practicing again December 7th. You know, are you prepared for it? You know, are you eating well? Do you need anything? That type of thing is very, very important.
All right.
To build kids' trust.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Just something that you said, I got another question, but this one just popped into my head. You talked about asking your players, are they eating well? I'm just curious, when you were at Ohio State, was there much talk about nutrition with the coaching staff? Like, did they ever talk to you about what you should be eating or shouldn't be eating? I'm just curious because I think about my experience when I played at Kent. I was there from 88 to 92. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we ever really had much discussion about nutrition or what you were supposed to be eating. And I think about like having practice on a Saturday morning for three and a half hours and then immediately heading right to Ponderosa and drinking like 2 gallons of soda and a steak and chicken wings and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious because I know obviously today we have so much more knowledge and there's so much more information that's available to players and coaches. But just, I'm just curious for your own experience back when you were at Ohio State, did, was that talked about nutrition at that point?
Not at all. Not at all. It's funny that you asked that question because I, you know, I talked to my kids about that because I don't eat pork and beef now. It's probably been about 16 years, 17 years since I've had it. But no, not at all. Like you said, at Ohio State, you know, you got a training table. So after practice daily, Mr. G was always up in the room cooking these fabulous meals. And, you know, you can, like you said, steak, cheeseburger, mashed potatoes, whatever it was, you know, we ate good every single day. All right. Now the whole nutrition piece didn't come, you know, come around and I don't know what, 12, 15 years ago, 10
yeah,
years ago.
That's probably about right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And now, but you know, it's funny because it really helps with your, with how you feel
for sure.
When you're taking care of yourself. So, you know, again, I wish we did have something like that back in the day, but no, we never had that back then. We just, like you said, we wanted to go to Ponderosa and get a plate full of wings and a plate full of steaks.
Yep.
And that's what we would do. That's
absolutely
what we do. Yeah. We ate good on campus. We did eat good.
All right. Let me ask you a little bit about recruiting. This is a question. I know you mentioned earlier that you had some involvement with AAU basketball. And so I'm curious, as a college coach, when you go out and you recruit and you're looking at evaluating a player, and there's two main settings where you're going to be able to look at a player and what they can do. And that's with their high school team and then in the summer with their AAU team. So when you're looking at those two environments and you're looking at a player, are you looking for different things in each one of those environments? Do you weigh one of those environments more heavily than the other? Just give me your perspective on what you're looking for when you go out and recruit a player.
Well, I do. I mean, first of all, we identify what positions we need, okay? And then once we identify what positions we need, we look to see what a kid can do, all right, as far as his basketball skill. Now, it's funny you say that because on the AAU circuit, with that being the platform for college coaches to come see kids play, you already know what you're going to get. You're going to get a lot of selfish basketball, okay? So now you got to try to see through the clutter on the AAU side because you're going to be getting kids trying to do things that your high school coach is not going to allow them to do, all right? So we look at both. We look at them in the AAU circuit. We look on the AAU circuit, okay? We're going to evaluate there. Might not get a great reading. We might get a good reading as far as the skill set on that level, okay? Because, again, it's selfish basketball. But now when we identify a kid and we find out what school he goes to and we go to one of their practices, now we're going to see more like a team setting, okay? There's going to be a lot more structure because they've been together for a while. There's going to be guys sharing the basketball. There's going to be, you know, that type of thing. So you want to see how he interacts with his teammates. And I think you can kind of get a better feel when you see him with his high school as far as that goes versus his AAU program. Because a lot of these kids that come together for AAU, they come from different schools. They come from different cities in that state. And then they just come together on the weekend and they play. They're not doing any practicing, you know, like they would on a high school level. So, yeah, you get a feel for both are very, very important. OK, because again, I could tell a whole lot about a player seeing him on the AAU circuit and seeing him on the high school circuit.
Yeah, I think you have to weigh both of them. It's just I'm always curious to hear what college coaches have to say about what they look for when they evaluate each one of those given places. Do you have any advice for a high school parent or the parent of a high school athlete when it comes to recruiting and what their level of involvement is? And obviously it's different for every family and circumstances are always different, but just maybe some general advice for parents who are trying to help their child in the process rather than hurt their child in the process. Mm-hmm. And maybe the same thing from a high school coach's perspective. Like when you go in and talk to a high school coach, what are you hoping to get from them? So I guess advice for a high school parent and advice for a high school coach to help the athlete in the recruiting process?
Well, I think the biggest thing is the advice I would give to a parent is that, like you just said, don't hurt your kid. And it's funny because the majority of parents, or a lot of parents, I should say, nowadays, they hurt their kids. And what we do is, what my staff and I do is, we recruit everybody. If I'm recruiting you, Mike, I want to know who you're around. I need to know parents. I need to know friends. I need to know the people that you seem to be around a lot. Okay, I need to know what type of people they are, because again, and this is why I stayed away from that's why I don't do the high school thing. You know, I don't want you, you know, if you're a parent and that's your son, you're always going to love your son. Okay. And they're always going to be your kid, but your kid might not be as good as what you think he is. Okay.
So, are you serious, Dennis? Are you for real? That's true.
Oh yeah.
Come on.
You know how it is. You're the player, you've been through it and you've done it. So, you know, so I think if I had to give any advice to a parent, just be careful. Let your kid go out and play and let them be who they are, and let us do our job in regard to evaluating him. And if we tell you something that you don't like, or your son is not playing as much as you would like, you can't get offended by that, because again, I see him every day. I know his talent. And like I tell my kids, I don't play you. You play yourself. Okay. And it's funny that, like I tell them, you audition every day. You audition every single day. Okay. Last year you had 90 some auditions. We practiced 90 plus times last year. So you had 90 practices to go out and prove that you were more than capable of getting playing time if you wanted to play.
That's so true. What about with high school coaches? What are some things when you go out and you talk to a high school coach, what are you looking for in the conversation that you have with a high school coach? I can guess what the main thing is that you're looking for, but I'm just curious to hear what your answer is.
Personality and attitude. Okay. And it's funny you asked that, because, you know, every team has captains, right? Every team has captains, but you know what I do? It's easy to pick a captain, but like I give them a piece of paper and I say, whose attitude do you want this team to take after? Whose attitude? Whose demeanor would you like this team? If you could pick one of these guys on your team, okay, pick one of your teammates, whose attitude do you want this team to take after? And that's very hard for them guys. That's very, very hard for a guy to tell you. And you know, I want more than just captains. I want guys that have the attitude, okay, to where, hey, you're going to come every day. You're going to do what you need to do. More important, you're going to get your guys to buy into that. And then everybody's attitude becomes the same.
I think that's so important when you can get, we always hear that talk about a player-led culture as opposed to a coach-led culture, and talking about how when the players can be the ones that enforce the culture and say, hey, this is the way we do things here. And if you're
going to
do it that way, you know, hey, we can't have that, because that's not the way we do things here. If we want to win, we want to be successful. And I think that that's something that all coaches strive to do, but yet I think it's something that is difficult to do, because you have to give your kids, I think, an opportunity to act as leaders. And sometimes we as coaches want to have leaders, but we don't really actively try to develop them or give them opportunities to lead. So how do you find opportunities for your kids to step into leadership roles, which means that you and your staff probably have to take a step back, maybe in certain areas? How do you go about doing that?
Man, you know, like I tell my team, this team is for sale. And the great thing about it is it don't cost you a dime. All right. Whoever wants to own this team, step up and own it. But here's the thing, though. You got to make sure what you're trying to get somebody to do, if you're a player, what you're trying to get somebody to do, you got to make sure that you're doing it, okay? Because you're not going to be looked upon as a leader if you're not doing what you need to do, what you're trying to tell somebody else what to do.
Yeah, that is so true. I think that one of the things that players struggle with, and I think it's one of the things that you see when you coach for a long time, is you'll have kids who – it's the best situation is when your best player is your hardest worker. I mean, there's no question about that. There's no question about that. And so I think the most frustrating teams, if I look back on my coaching career, the most frustrating teams that I've ever coached or been associated with are the ones where your best player has a questionable work ethic or has a questionable attitude, because then you're fighting with that best player nonstop to try to get them to kind of get over the hump and come around. And meanwhile, all the other guys that are kind of following and looking to that player for leadership and looking to you for leadership, they're seeing that conflict in the relationship, and it makes it really tough. And conversely, when your best player is the one that you can count on and hold up as an example, man, everything falls in line from there. So I think as a coach, and I'm sure that you've seen it in all your different stops, that when you can get that pecking order right and get that hierarchy in line, that it just makes everything so much easier to deal with from a coaching perspective.
It does. It's funny because I had four last year. I have four guys that we picked. Okay. And they're all great kids. Everybody's high character, great kids. Okay. But as far as your personality, okay, it was, you know, again, I wanted more. I wanted more, and I didn't want it to be coming from myself, and I didn't want it to be coming from the, I wanted to be assistant coach. So I want more. So that's, again, in talking to people, I came up with the, you know, whose personality slash attitude would you want this team to take after? No, which one? Who is it? And I let them pick. Okay. And then I write at the bottom of the paper, why? Why are you picking this person? Okay, but at the end of the day, Mike, if it's not a player that I want, or the ones that they pick I don't like, we won't have captains. We'll do it by committee. Okay, right before the games, I'll tell whoever I want to go out there and represent the team. That's what we do.
I love that it's a different spin on the question of, again, whose demeanor, whose attitude would you want this team to reflect? It's a different way than saying, hey, who do you want to be the captain?
That's right.
Or sometimes can almost just kind of be, you know, I'm going to pick the best player. And maybe the best player shouldn't always be the captain. And so I think what you've done with that question is you've given players an opportunity to stop and really think about what it is that they're doing. It just kind of frames it in a different way. And I bet you get better results than you would if you just said, hey, who do you want to be the captain?
That's right, because last year, again, they picked four guys, and again, love those guys, but again, they weren't the type of captain that I want. So I came up with the whose personality do you want the team to take after, and why?
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. I want to ask you a question about the totality of your coaching career, and the question is, what do you think? Right from the very beginning as a coach, you were pretty good at? And then what's something that at the beginning you feel like was maybe a weakness that over the course of your entire career that you've been able to improve upon to the point now where you feel like that is something that was a strength that started out as a weakness? So something you've been good at from the beginning and a weakness that you've turned into a strength over the course of your career.
Well, I think at the beginning it was my background. I'm going to be honest with you. I think my background, that helps. That helps because been there, done that, already walked where you guys are trying to walk, you know, and they caught on that real quick. Okay. So I think that was one of the main strength of mine was I'd have been there. I used to be you. I used to be coached by people. Just like you guys are going to be coached by us as a staff, okay? Now, a weakness is not being patient, not understanding why I could see something and do something, but they couldn't see and do. Okay, so that patience learned that patience and not being patient turned into, okay, they're not you. They're not you. Okay. So that turned into, okay, they're not me. So you got to do a little extra to help. Okay. Them raise their basketball savvy, their basketball intellect. Okay. Their IQ for the game. So that's what I learned so far as being a head coach.
Yeah. That's good stuff. I think that there's no question about that. As I think former players, I think it's very difficult to sometimes get your head around the fact that why can't this kid see the things that I'm seeing, or why don't they work as hard as I worked. And I struggled with that for a long time trying to figure that out. I remember my first job as a JV basketball coach. I walked into practice on day one and I was by myself, and first time I'd ever coached a practice, and I got 10th graders that are in front of me, and we're going up and down the floor. And I just remember after like 5 minutes thinking to myself, I just witnessed like 5,000 things that I want to fix. Mm-hmm. And how am I possibly going to do that? And it took me a long time. And even now there's times where you still kind of revert to yourself as a player. Mm-hmm. You just think, why can't they do that? Like, why can't mm-hmm. they see that? And I think that's something that if you've played, that I think coaches that have played always struggle with that, Dennis. I just think they do.
Yeah. And that was a big struggle of mine. But again, I think that weakness is kind of turned into a positive, because now you're a little more patient.
Yep.
And then you got to do a little more breakdown. And more importantly, man, during your breakdown, you gotta have conversation to go with it. Okay, you just can't say, I want you to do. You got to have camaraderie. Right, this is what I want you to do, and this is why. Okay, depending on what the action is, look, if I come off this ball screen and I got a hedge guy and I got my main defender, I got two, somebody's open somewhere. So you got to know plays, and you just got to break it down a little more. Because they're not you.
Yep, and I think that why that you just mentioned is something I think back to, and I don't know about your experiences, but my experience as a player was the why was really never shared with me. It was mm-hmm. just, look, this is what you're going to do. And as a player, you just kind of accepted it. You did what you were told, and you really never asked the question why. And I think nowadays coaches do a much better job of sharing the why. And I think players are much more likely to ask for that why than they were back in the era when you and I played.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right.
We are coming up, Dennis, close to an hour and a half. So I want to wrap up by asking you one final question, and it's kind of a two-parter. So the first part of the question is, when you look ahead there at Lourdes, and let's say over the next year, 2-3 years, and let's eliminate COVID from it and assume that at some point we're going to get back to normal, what do you see as your biggest challenge moving forward? And then part two of the question is, what's your biggest joy when you get out of bed in the morning and you think about being the head men's basketball coach at Lawrence University? What brings you the biggest joy about that? So your biggest challenge and your biggest joy.
Biggest obstacle for myself is probably not having full scholarships. And again, you're going to be now NAI, there's no more NAI 2. All NAIs are 1 now. Okay. So you're going to have some teams like your Georgetowns and those guys that they get full scholarships. Okay. There's no way that we can compete against those type of guys. All right. And I learned this from Coach Massimino. If you want to be the best, okay, you're not the best at that time. You better figure out what the best is doing, and you better be able to do it the same. More importantly, do it better. Okay. So the biggest struggle, not struggle, because we always going to make it work. Okay, I wouldn't be there if we couldn't make it work. But the biggest challenge is that I might not have – I mean, I don't get the scholarships that some of these schools get on this level. That's a challenge. That's a challenge. I have to take what I get and make it work. And that's a challenge. It's not a fair playing field. Okay, so that is always going to be a challenge.
Absolutely. All right, biggest joy.
Biggest joy, man, is getting out of bed every morning, man, and giving or sharing – a lot of knowledge that I have to give, man, to young guys, man, that's going to be transitioning into the real world someday. That's my biggest joy. And I love the game of basketball, and I got a lot of knowledge that I can share. So why keep it to myself?
Getting to spend every day in the game, I think there's nothing better than that for people who love it. And I just think that, you know, your passion for the game of basketball tonight came through loud and clear. And I just want to say, on a personal level, I'm so appreciative that you took the opportunity to come and join us and have this conversation tonight. I appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule, and I can't thank you enough for joining us. Before we get out, why don't you go ahead and share where people can find out more about your program at Lourdes, how they can connect with you, and then I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Okay, well, you can go to the website, which is Lourdes, Lourdes.edu, and always click on men's basketball. That would give you our schedule. That would give you all the information about the program. the kids, myself, the staff, and then through social media, which is my own personal social media. I mean, I respond to people on Twitter. It's D Hopson. I'm sorry, Dennis Hopson, too. And that's the best way to get a hold of me, if not call my office phone.
Perfect. We'll put all that stuff in the show notes so that people can find it. If they want to reach out to you, find out more about your program, or just pick your brain on some basketball stuff. And again, like I said, I appreciate you being willing to jump on with us. It was a pleasure for me to get an opportunity to talk to you about your playing career, your coaching career, all the great things that you've been doing in the game. And I'm sure there's a really bright future of what you're going to do moving forward. So again, Dennis, thank you so much. And everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
If you have an existing podcast or are looking to launch your own pod but aren't sure where to start, the team at My Podcast Manager can help. Our podcast team works behind the scenes so you can do what you do best. We'll help you launch your podcast, make it sound great, and free up your time for the more enjoyable parts of podcasting. If you're ready to put your podcast editing, production, and promotion on autopilot with a trusted team of podcasting professionals, visit mypodcastmanager.com. to get started.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.